This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The Luddites were a labor movement, and we can't forget this. They were a labor movement, an organized, militant labor movement, at a time where there was no real organized militant labor movements.
Jathan Sadowski examines how tech capital fuels the war machine, tracing a line from Luddite resistance to today's resistance to AI militarization.
2 million people served in the Middle East during the war on terror, and thousands of these white supremacist neo-Nazi gang members are now back in the US, and they're not coming back to the US to be priests or choir boys.
Matthew Kennard, author of Irregular Army, How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals, talks about the thousands of extremists who served in the Middle East and have since returned to the United States.
The cycle of create, contain, cure entrenches a dependency on central vaccine production and surveillance systems, further consolidating institutional power over global health.
Dr. Peter McCulloch warns of the immense dangers posed by dual-use biolabs in the U.S. and around the globe, pursuing biowarfare measures and countermeasures that could be the origin of the next global pandemic. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. The Industrial Revolution gave birth to the Luddites, mostly artisan weavers and textile workers, who fought to defend their livelihoods and communities against the upheavals caused by mechanization. Jathan Sadowski, a professor of information technology at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, explores these connections in his new book, The Mechanic and the Luddites. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I'm very proud to be part of a kind of resurgence of resuscitating this legacy of Luddism. And, you know, on one hand, really trying to get a much more, a crystal clear vision of the history of Luddism. Right now, our view of what Luddism means and what the original Luddite movement, you know, stood for is very much muddied. It's muddied by, you know, more than 200 years of using Luddism and Luddite as a kind of derogatory term for being technophobic, for fearing progress, for being primitivist in some way, you know. And this is very much a concerted campaign by capital, and to, you know, kind of create this culture of, you know, you should don't be like the Luddites. I mean, it's actually really quite unusual that we still have that term in our vocabulary today, that we have some sense that the Luddites existed, because when you look back at the history, we're not usually taught the history of, you know, of people who are framed as losers and failures, you know, and the Luddites are very much, you know, framed as failures and losers in you know, the history of the Industrial Revolution. And to be sure, they, you know, they did not achieve what they set out to do, which was to, you know, really upend this emerging political economy around industrial factories and industrial capitalism and the use of old and new machinery to immiserate life for workers. You know, They failed at achieving that goal because the concerted force of the state, working in unison with capital, stepped in to make machine breaking a treasonous offense against the state of England, punishable by hanging, right? But I think one reason why we still remember the Luddites, why this is still part of our vocabulary, is because it's told as this kind of cautionary tale. You know, you shouldn't be like the Luddites. You know, don't stand in the way of technology, don't stand in the way of progress, don't stand in the way of, you know, capitalist innovations and disruptions to your life. Because if you do, not only are you a technophobe and a primitivist, but you remember what happened to the Luddites. They got hung. They got, you know, strung up in the town center, right? Like, and so I think we have this idea of Luddism as this derogatory history, as a cautionary tale. But my work, the book, you know, work by people like Brian Merchant, a new book by a geographer in the UK, Thomas de Kessier, called Techno Negative, it's kind of starting to resuscitate this idea that, well, the actual original Luddites were not technophobes. They were mechanics. They were artisans. They were skilled tradespeople. They were people who worked with these machines, did these crafts day in and day out. They were experts. They knew how it worked, which gave them a unique position to understand how changes in the workplace and the labor relation being enacted and forced upon them by this new class of industrial capitalists, they understood what that meant for their lives and their communities in the immediate sense. They could see how these technologies, the problem was not the technologies in and of themselves, the problem was how the technologies were being used and for what purpose and to whose ends they were being used. You know, the Luddites understood that technology is a choice made by people, and it gives shape to the workplace, it gives shape to our communities and our societies. And as with any choice made by people that affects your lives, you should have a right to, you know, to push back against it, to have your say, to have your values and perspectives represented. And that is what the Luddites tried to do. They organized, they tried to petition, they tried to negotiate, they tried to protest. And at every attempt, they were stymied, you know, dismissed, ignored, degraded in some ways, denigrated in various ways. And so at the end of the day, the way we understand the Luddites today as a, you know, kind of willy-nilly swinging hammers at any machine in their, you know, in their field of vision, that's not true. They did smash machines, but this was only at the end of a long process of trying to protest, petition, negotiate, and being turned away and stymied at every case. And only then did they come together and follow their criticism of these technologies to their ruthless endpoints, to the logical conclusions. And so I think the lessons of Luddism today are many-folded, but one is to understand technologies in a materialist sense, not just view them as like what the promises and ideology and propaganda around the technologies, you know, the hype around what they are, what, you know, what the companies and the owners claim that they are, what they can do, right? But to understand them in a real mechanical, material sense of how they actually work, what they actually do, what they can't do, and how they're affecting our lives. I think that kind of immediate present tense analysis, as the historian David Noble called it, is really important. And from there, understanding as well that technology is, at the end of the day, an issue for societies, for communities, and for labor. The Luddites were a labor movement, and we can't forget this. They were a labor movement, an organized, militant labor movement, at a time where there was no real organized militant labor movements. They were, you know, real vanguards in that sense, and they understood technology as a social issue, as a political issue, as an economic issue, but ultimately as a labor issue. And I think that those are lessons that we need to draw from the Luddites today.
And of course, Marx and Engels studied the Industrial Revolution in Britain to understand the work of capitalism, how capitalism was working and how it was organized. And that study of that was very important to understanding capitalism and to know what was going to happen in capitalism.
That's exactly right, because I very much adhere to the kind of materialist analysis in my book, you know, and very much drawing directly from the Marx and Engels, and understanding that, as I say in my book, you know, I talk about technological capitalism as just, you know, as the latest kind of modifier, adjective, flavor of ultimately the same political economic system of capitalism. But much as I talk about in my book that to understand technological capitalism, we have to analyze it in motion, in action. What you're describing here with the real landmark studies that Marx and Engels undertook of, you know, the working class in England, of, you know, the many volumes of Capital, the many other writings, right, is they were able to derive such a incisive and long-lasting analysis of capitalism because they analyzed the thing in motion, at, you know, as a process in action. And so, you know, much as the Industrial Revolution provided the kind of natural laboratory for Marx to understand these real dynamics and imperatives and processes of capital, I think today, you know, what we're seeing now around technological capitalism, this kind of, you know, these this new flavor of capitalism gives us an opportunity to at once understand and study this thing in process as a way, just as Marx and Engels set out to do, not just to study it for the sake of studying it, but to study it to understand how it works, but also where its weak points are, right? Where its contradictions are, how it can unravel, whether by its own hand or by the hand of the working class.
And of course, the in the Second World War, the development of technology was important. In fact, throughout history, wars have brought about the development of technology, even the Civil War in the United States. But the digital revolution, if you want, after the end of the Second World War, and the development of use of digital technology for exploitation and for profiteering. Why don't you talk about that and how that early beginning reflected the kind of the method of capitalism and technology?
Yeah, and I think one reason why we see such, spurts, great, acceleration of innovation and of technological development coming out of war, and we do, right? I mean, war is a catalyst for enormous amounts of technological development. And the reason for that, I think, is very simple. It's because war mobilizes resources and purposes on a grand scale. There's a lot of money and resources going around, a lot of authority to enroll any systems and labor and capital into the war machine. And there's a lot of purpose there. There's purpose driving the technology, right? We must build technologies to do a thing, to kill the enemy better, to surveil our enemies better, to mobilize logistics and resources in more efficient and optimized ways. And I think that war is this case. Very often war was really one of the only cases where you would see this vast mobilization of resources and purposes put towards one end. But now I think what we see out of Silicon Valley and out of the grand kind of private markets that Silicon Valley is actually built on, right? It's not just the public companies with, massive untold valuations. It's largely the private markets. It's the private equity firms. It's the venture capital firms. It's the corporate venture capital. It's the startups, right? That's where so much money now exists. And what we see is a ability in Silicon Valley now to coordinate, to mobilize untold, unprecedented amounts of resources towards one end, right? But that end now is, to maximize the extraction of value, to concentrate financial wealth and social power into a small number of hands. And this is done through coordination. I talk about this in my book. I have a whole chapter. The chapter titled Innovation is actually a chapter about venture capital. It's about this, we really need better analysis and better understanding of the mechanisms of venture capital, how this way of gathering and collating and raising huge amounts of institutional capital from pension funds, from university endowments, from private equity funds, hedge funds, and coordinating that money into bubbles, ultimately, right? And understanding bubbles as essentially the herd mentality of investors in Silicon Valley, where everyone kind of follows the decisions made by a handful of the, there are three or four of the major venture capital funds like A16Z, Andreessen Horowitz, or Sequoia Capital, or Founders Fund, right? These venture capital funds that raise tens of billions of dollars every year and then make decisions. They're the kingmakers, right? They're giving purpose towards this is what we're going to invest in. This is what everyone else is going to put their money in. And so you get what seems to be unprecedented amounts of innovation on the scale of total mobilization for war. But for what, right? When you have mobilization for war, you get unprecedented innovation and, machines for killing and surveilling and doing all kinds of horrible things. And then every once in a while, you get some trickle-down innovation, right? The kind of trickle-down benefits of something that maybe comes into being a consumer good. And this was actually the start of Silicon Valley.
Was that the internet, the development of the internet?
Yes, 100%, right? The internet, well, the internet starts as a research network, and then from there it becomes the World Wide Web in 1993, where once venture capitalists and investors in Silicon Valley see that there's potential here for having an infrastructure that can actually can be an economic infrastructure, and so it's very interesting. Venture capital comes out of ways of trying to commercialize innovations in post-World War II. So, lots of technologies are developed in World War II because of military investment. And then out of that, the US government is looking for ways to commercialize those technologies. And that becomes the birth of venture capital in Silicon Valley, because, of course, so many Silicon Valley companies started because of the military industrial complex. Building chips for missiles, for example, was, as Fairfield Semiconductors did. And so you see this real deep relationship between the total mobilization of investment for war and the total mobilization of investment for capital. And, Silicon Valley is the kind of, real ground zero of that. And this relationship has been there from the beginning. And now you see, in some ways, it's not an inversion of the relationship, but it's not clear which hand is the upper hand here, when you have companies like Anthropic and OpenAI and Anduril, Palantir, in having deep relationships with the Pentagon. But it's more than just military contracts. The Pentagon is now trying to reorganize itself to be more like a startup, to be more like a tech company, to think like Silicon Valley. And so
And that
the
was
thing that
privatization under the Democrats and Republicans of NASA, all these public institutions funded by the people, then privatized and given to private capitalist entrepreneurs.
That's exactly right. And then bringing those entrepreneurs like Eric Schmidt, the former CEO and chairman of Google, who's one of the real kind of, translators between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon. And, he sits on the Defense Innovation Board, and he was put there by Obama, and, as a way to create these deeper relationships. And we see now with the second Trump administration, those relationships have just become deeper and deeper and deeper, as the distinction between tech company and, the Pentagon is that distinction is starting to blur in these ways, where they become mutually dependent on each other, but they also start mutually shaping each other. The Pentagon wants to be more like a tech company, and tech companies want to be more like military agencies. And so you see this kind of convergence happening, which is, it speaks to the history of Silicon Valley coming out of the military industrial complex. This has always been there in the industry.
That was Jathan Sadowski on the history of the Luddite movement and its relevance today. He was interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Sometimes when I was driving, I'd listen to the radio. And I used to read the paper sitting in the metro. Then I'd put it down and greet someone I see with a random comment, 'cause that's how it used to be. But now no one says hello. Oh.
That was Dave Rovics, performed by AI Suno, From Dawn to Dusk to Dawn. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. Next, we examine the hidden machinery of empire, the structural decay of the so-called War on Terror, and its lasting impact abroad and at home. Matt Kinnard, author of Irregular Army, How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals, explains how all the troops needed to sustain the Iraq and Afghanistan occupations led the U.S. military to lower enlistment standards, allowing white supremacists, gang members, and more to receive state-funded combat training. He begins with the phenomenon of the irregular army, thousands of extremists who served in the Middle East and have since returned to the United States. Investigative journalist Kit Clarenberg situates this within a broader shift toward special forces warfare and the normalization of atrocities, tracing it back to the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia and the subsequent interventions across West Asia. Here is part of Matt Kinnard's and Kit Clarenberg's conversation with Karim Betash and Peter Beatty, hosts of BetBeat Media.
So the book is Irregular Army, but the subtitle is How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals. And I'll run through this quickly because it is quite a long story. But effectively, the thesis of the book is that the U.S. military broke during the War on Terror, i.e. that it couldn't staff the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And in the absence of doing conscription, which the Bush administration and Obama after him didn't want to do because they knew that that was the straw that broke the camel's back in Vietnam, really it was conscription that turned the country against the war in Vietnam and then pressure for withdrawal increased. They didn't want that with Iraq. So what they did instead is they kept an all-volunteer army but got rid of regulations that had previously been in place. Some of these was public, like they raised the enlistment age from 35 to 42, which they've actually just redone, by the way. And we should talk about how it relates to the contemporary situation, but some of it was secret. And that was the bit I focused on. So the main bit of the book is about neo-Nazis. And when I was in the States, I was interviewing countless neo-Nazi groups and also former DOD, now DOW investigators. And basically, they just told me that it was carte blanche for neo-Nazis and white supremacists during the War on Terror, by which I mean the best way of kind of knowing that someone's an extremist, absent them actually telling you, which they don't often do, is tattoos, because all these groups use tattoos to show their allegiance. And they were telling me, we can get in easily with the swastika, we can get in with Norse runes, crusader, neo-crusader imagery. And it was a complete free-for-all during the War on Terror. And this had a huge impact on the occupied populations, obviously, because if you're sending white supremacist neo-Nazis to a country full of brown people armed with an M16, you're going to see atrocities. And there were atrocities across the board. And there was one particular guy called Kenneth Eastridge who was serving in Iraq. And he came back to the US and with two other soldier veterans killed someone and was put in prison. And actually, this is how it always happened. The only accountability that US soldiers ever got was when they came back to the US. Anything they did in Iraq was never prosecuted. But during his trial, his colleagues who were involved in the murder who said, we used to go around Baghdad just taking pot shots at locals, and that was standard. So you see this across the board. Then there's gangs, which obviously are tens of thousands of gangs joined up, and that links to the drug war in Mexico as well, because often Mexican drug gangs were using active duty soldiers, because there's quite a few benefits to having active duty soldiers in your gang, like the fact that they move around, they have a certain protection being soldiers, they have access to weaponry, and Fort Bliss in Texas was a hotbed of this. And then criminals as well. So criminals, they have this thing called the Moral Waiver Program, which was that there are regulations on if you're a felon or if you have a serious misdemeanor to your name, you can't enlist. But they got this program called the Moral Waiver Program, which basically just wiped the slate clean, took off massively. And again, this had a huge impact. One particular massacre called the Mamadia Massacre, which became famous, where a group of US soldiers went and raped a 14-year-old girl and then killed her and her whole family. And then burnt the house down. That was the leader of that was called Stephen D. Green, and he got into the US military on a moral waiver. Now, that again, that case is quite interesting because, again, that case would not have been publicized because they burnt the house down and said it was the work of insurgents. And then it was only someone in their platoon who had a crisis of conscience and said what had happened that eventually they got prosecuted for that. So to bring it back to now, 2 million people served in the Middle East during the war on terror. And thousands of these white supremacist neo-Nazi gang members are now back in the US, and they're not coming back to the US to be priests or choir boys. They want to use the training they've got courtesy of the US taxpayer to start what they call ROHOA, which is racial holy war. And you see, if you look at local newspapers, you see a steady tick of incidents of veterans involved in violent crimes, murders, drugs, drug trafficking, all this kind of stuff. So it's had a huge impact on American society. And then, just to bring it up to now, you have, and this is the mad thing, is that when I was investigating all this stuff, it was like I was seeing this imagery on soldiers in Kandahar and Fallujah and places, and now you've got Pete Hegseth, who's the Secretary of War. He changed the name of the Department of Defense to the Department of War, which is actually more honest. We should give him some credit for that. But he himself has a Jerusalem cross on his chest. He has the word kafir in Arabic written on his arm, which is a sign that kafir is an Arabic term which is used by some Muslims to indicate unbelievers and infidels. And he wears that as a source of pride to show, like, I'm a kafir, I'm the enemy of Islam. And he's the top official in the Pentagon, the most powerful military in human history. And he talks about the war in Iran like a crusader. He says, he speaks in neo-crusader imagery, language, like his neo-crusader imagery on it tattooed on his body. So the story really comes full circle. And this is the big point, is that we're often meant to see Trump as a kind of outlier and a wild sort of aberration within the American system. But all the stuff that was put in place by Bush and Obama during the war on terror allowed for someone like Trump, because the Bush administration, you know, they called it the imperial presidency. They really concentrated executive power to the detriment of the legislative branch. And you're seeing that now. I don't even know, does America still have a legislative branch? We never hear about it. They can't do anything. A lot of that was put into place, and also allowing the free-for-all with extremists and white supremacists and neo-Nazis really created the ground for someone like Pete Hegseth to come in. So I think that this is a real, real important lens to view what has happened to America since 2016 through. And you saw it in some ways with Vietnam. You know, there was a massive uptick of paramilitary and white supremacist activity after the Vietnam War, as disillusioned veterans came home, and they were again, they felt they weren't treated right. They'd fought in a war which had ambiguous results. You know, it was seen as a failure, much like the war on terror. And also, to go back to the early 20th century, you know, the birth of fascism in Italy. That was Mussolini used a lot of veterans of the First World War. And again, it was although Italy won, they didn't get the people who fought said, what have we actually got for winning and all these sacrifices we've made? And he took advantage of that. And you're seeing that with Trump, you know, because obviously the war on terror was a bipartisan failure. It was the Democrats and the Republicans. So he comes in as this outsider who says he's going to make America great again. No more regime change, democracy building wars. Well, we know that was a lie, but he used all that rhetoric and riled up an American population, which was scarred by these wars, to really get into power. So you're kind of seeing history replay itself. But when you talk about the rise of fascism in the States, and I think it is what we're seeing is the rise of fascism, you don't often hear the military explanation. And I think it's a very, very important one, because obviously we know that half the congressional budget in the US is spent on the Pentagon. It's by some estimates, $1.4 trillion a year. It's the most important institution within US society. US is now what's called a stratocracy. It's ruled by the military. And I think to understand America, you have to understand the military institution. And the book really is an investigation into the reality of what's happening there underneath all the propaganda.
And weirdly, it's one of the most trusted institutions in the U.S., if polls are to be believed. Just one really quick follow-up question. Is this at all related, do you think, to the rise of special forces operations? Or do you think these are two kind of separate developments?
I mean, it is as well, because obviously secrecy generates corruption and criminal activity. And the special forces are much more secretive than the regular military. I didn't actually look too much into the special forces. forces because I didn't have the access. But Seth Harp, the American journalist, has just written a best-selling book, which is really, really good, called The Fort Bragg Cartel, which goes into this and how much criminal activity happens at Fort Bragg within the special forces. So it's related. But that is a major, major trend in military since the war on terror, basically, because part of the reason this all went to is because Rumsfeld's idea was he wanted a slim down US military, right? His whole idea was you just send in small special forces missions. And in fact, in Afghanistan, that worked initially. They bribed local warlords and got to Kabul pretty quickly and took over that country pretty quickly. Obviously, it became a bit of a disastrous occupation, but he thought they could do the same in Iraq. And they were not ready for the level of occupation that was needed and the level of troops. And that was why they hadn't planned for it. They couldn't deal with it without conscription. So this debate rolls on again, you know, like how big should we have a big land army? Should we just focus on agile, flexible special forces? And this is a debate that goes on in the military now. But I don't know too much about what happens within the special forces. But if you really want the story on that, look at Seth Harp's book.
Right. I noticed that it's good that you mentioned this whole case of the 14-year-old girl, because this is often ignored. People always talk about, oh, they talk about torture and they talk about brutal killings, yeah, and going to villages and shooting people and all that stuff. But sex trafficking is a very big issue. I actually remember reading about a case that was actually found in the WikiLeaks about what happened in Iraq and how many soldiers were actually raping children in Iraq and also impregnating them and then killing them. And this stuff, nobody has ever been prosecuted for that stuff. I mean, this is really, really evil, sick stuff that is happening there. And when you're saying about those neo-Nazis, Matt, I actually remember a conversation that Peter and I recently had with Anthony Aguilar from, he's a soldier, he was a private contractor, former soldier, then private contractor, and went to Gaza to... he thought to help, but he found out it was one big gang of crazies that were part of those private contractors. For example, what you're saying as well, he said that one group called the Infidels, I think, the Infidels or something, which are hardcore. What's that, Peter?
Infidel motorcycle gang.
Yeah, Infidel motorcycle gang, who are also hardcore right-wing Christian fascistic types. And they go into Palestine to rape and murder innocent Palestinians. Mm. And this is the kind of immoral way that US empire is throwing onto the world. And it's going completely mayhem. It's going completely crazy. I mean, you had the right-wing death squads, of course, in Latin America. And of course, you, Kit, you did a lot of research on the funding of terroristic and extremist types in West Asia, just like these terroristic types in Ukraine. And I think that is very much related to what Matt said, Kit, that kind of dynamic of these private militias for the US empire. We see the same in West Asia right now, and also the Kurds, for example, that they want to mobilize against Iran. Am I seeing that correctly, Kit?
I do think that the war on terror is ground zero for a large number of issues that we're seeing today. I think it absolutely, in many ways, laid the foundations for the genocidal disaster of the war on Iran as well, in more ways than one. But I think it goes back even further if you go back to 1999, and then you have the NATO bombed Serbia for 78 straight days without UN Security Council clearance. That kind of created the world in every way that we're living in now. It inspired interventionists on both sides of the Atlantic. It's often forgotten that Tony Blair was like really pressuring the US to bomb civilian targets, to deploy ground forces. And then when Milosevic capitulates after 78 days, suddenly the narrative becomes, well, Blair's been proven right, and his belligerent, force first strategy should be repeated and repeated over and over again. And of course, then in the wake of 9/11, you have Tony Blair immediately contact George Bush and start pressuring him to launch a wave of muscular military interventions across West Asia. I think the ultimate plan was to invade Iran, like they'd done with Iraq and Afghanistan. They certainly had enough soldiers in countries bordering Iran to do that. But because it was such a disaster, And from a financial, military, and political perspective, the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, there were an enormous amount of adverse consequences as a result that we live with on a kind of cultural and societal level as well. If you look at what, say, for instance, Britain's SAS were doing in Afghanistan, it's been rather forgotten, but there's been an ongoing inquiry which is looking at the SAS activities in Afghanistan. I think it's a small window of like 2010 to 2013. And it basically has uncovered reams of evidence that British Special Forces squads who were tasked with locating and capturing suspected terrorists, quote unquote, were routinely murdering like unarmed civilians, then fabricating evidence to frame their victims as armed insurgents. And it got to the point where their excuses were so pathetic and obviously false that even their superiors were like mocking the fact that they were lying, in internal communications. But they were also extremely worried about, quote unquote, when the next WikiLeaks occurs, because they thought that they would get busted for doing this. And then the reality of the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, they were pointless, costly nightmares. And you mentioned that that Mamadiya rape, rape and murder case. I've listened to some podcasts by the whistleblower who exposed this, like the US military operative. He specifically talks about how their daily routine was just like walking around having to check every single vehicle if it had been mined with an IED. You don't know if you're gonna die or not. This is like deeply traumatizing stuff. And for what? You come back home, you're pissed off, and you have the option of getting involved in some kind of paramilitary nationalist force, or you can join become a government contractor and earn lots of money for doing what you were doing before, except at arm's length for the government. So it's not something that's particularly spoken about. It really should be, because particularly I saw Matt posted earlier today on the dreaded X about the D notice that was applied to the presence of British Special Forces in Gaza from the start of the Gaza genocide. I believe it was October 28th, 2023, that as we discussed when we last spoke, the Defense and Security Media Advisory Committee was moved very quickly to prevent reporting on the SAS being involved in quote-unquote counter-terrorist operations in Gaza. So we can imagine like the kind of thing that they've been doing there. This is now, there is zero absence a total absence of consideration within the mainstream about the reality of special forces. They remain kind of venerated, as these kind of heroic crack squads of crusading warriors, etc. Like they're presented in a very fluffy way in films and TV. They're really, really evil and dangerous, and they have a massive impact not only on the countries they're deployed to, but also back at home too. And I think that's something that Matt really nails in his book. Really vital reading.
Those were investigative journalists Matt Kennard and Kit Clarenberg speaking to Karim Betash and Peter Beatty, hosts of BetBeat Media.
Might I have your attention for just a moment, please? Wherever you might be, across the seven seas, serving in the armed forces of the mighty USA. Heading off to save civilization, they say. There are things you should know before it's too late. You're working for an empire, the United States, which is despised everywhere for invasions like this one, for trying to rule the planet with bombs and guns. Yes, around the world, so many people agree. It's a great day to leave the army.
That was Dave Rovics, performed by AI Suno, A Great Day to Leave the Army. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. According to Dr. Peter McCullough and other critics of the U.S. health bureaucracy's actions during the COVID-19 public health crisis, early treatment was deliberately suppressed to spur and then compel mass vaccination. This has created one of the greatest medical scandals of modern history. One can expect this tactic in the future. Pandemic pathogens will be presented to the public as untreatable, with the only solution being a government-issued genetic vaccine. In the United States, such work falls under a web of research categories called gain-of-function research, Pathogen Enhancement Research of Concern, otherwise PERC, and Dual Use Research of Concern, DURC. All of these, Gain of Function, PERC, and DURC, have drawn heavy scrutiny due to their possible overlap with bioweapons capabilities. The U.S. Biodefense Network spans dozens of federal, military, private, corporate, and university laboratories, including the National Institutes of Health, NIH, particularly the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, previously run by Dr. Anthony Fauci. This body funds major dual-use pathogen research under the banner of pandemic preparedness. What follows is a summary report from Dr. McCullough about U.S. biolabs working on pathogens of dual pandemic potential, i.e. biological agents and research programs that involve pathogens capable of causing a pandemic and preventing one, depending on how the knowledge or technology is used.
I'm going to give you a summary of U.S. biolabs working on pathogens of dual pandemic potential. This is a big deal. And I can tell you that our next big pandemic could occur from a lab right here in the United States. Despite the new Trump administration coming into power, they have done little or nothing to protect Americans against these threats. Now, dual pandemic potential refers to biological agents and research programs that involve pathogens capable of causing a pandemic and preventing one, depending on how the knowledge or technology is used. These programs sit at the intersection of pandemic preparedness and biosecurity risk. The same research that can produce vaccines or antiviral measures can also inadvertently or deliberately create more virulent or transmissible versions of existing pathogens. In the United States, such work falls under a web of research categories called gain-of-function research, pathogen enhancement research of concern, PERC, and dual use research of concern, DURC, D-U-R-C, all of which have drawn heavy scrutiny due to their possible overlap with bioweapons capabilities. Here's some information about the structure of U.S. biodefense and pathogen research. These are the major institutions that are involved. The U.S. Biodefense Network spans dozens of federal, military, and laboratory and private laboratories. The most relevant players include the National Institutes of Health, particularly the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, previously run by Anthony Fauci. This body funds major dual-use pathogen research under the banner of pandemic preparedness. The U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRIID, located at Fort Detrick, Maryland, responsible for high-level containment biosecurity level 4 experiments on Ebola, Marburg, anthrax, and other potential bioweapon class pathogens. The Department of Homeland Security operates a biolab such as the National Bio and Agro-Defense Facility, NBAF, in Kansas, replacing the Plum Island Animal Disease Center. These labs handle zoonotic pathogens, animal-to-human transmission, like common origin for pandemics. And then the Centers for Disease Control operates BSL-4 labs in Atlanta that handle smallpox and highly infectious viruses. Private contractors and universities, including EcoHealth Alliance, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Boston University, University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, numerous pharmaceutical partners. These institutions often carry out federally funded research, but with far less transparency than governmental labs. So here are the categories of dual pathogen research. So gain-of-function studies. Gain-of-function research involves modifying pathogens to increase transmissibility, virulence, or host range to study how pandemics might evolve naturally. Critics argue that such experiments create the very conditions for accidental pandemics. Example, modifying the avian influenza, H5N1, to become an airborne transmissible in humans. That was done at the USDA Research Center in Athens, Georgia. And to be clear, this is transmissible among male or ducks and then onto mammals. Another example is engineering coronaviruses with modified spike proteins to increase infectivity, done in Wuhan, China. Supporters claim these methods allow creation of preemptive vaccines. Detractors note that a single lab breach could unleash a pathogen far more dangerous than nature would ever produce. And that's exactly what happened with both bird flu and with COVID-19. Now, there's reverse vaccinology and synthetic pathogens. Advances in genetic engineering now allow scientists to create synthetic viruses, reconstructing extinct strains like smallpox relatives, or designing completely new ones to test vaccine platforms. COVID-19 accelerated this field as messenger RNA technology allowed rapid prototyping, but it also demonstrated how dual-use gene synthesis could be leveraged for malicious or unsafe gain-of-function work under the private or academic cover. Now, the biodefense simulations and challenge studies, human challenge trials where healthy volunteers are exposed to pathogens, often blur ethical boundaries, especially when strains are enhanced. A lesson from past biodefense simulations, such as the 2001 Dark Winter Anthrax exercise, is that preparedness often doubles as live lab work in the creation, testing, and containment of potential pandemic agents, meaning we never really know if a pathogen is capable of creating a pandemic until it gets out of the lab. Now, there's some major research examples of dual pandemic potential. So clearly, coronaviruses. Between 2014 and 2019, U.S.-funded researchers conducted experiments combining bat coronaviruses with humanized cell receptors. The stated goal, explore pandemic potential and test vaccine design. This research was controversial, not only because of its biosafety mismatches, some done in BSL-2 or BSL-3 conditions, where containment was insufficient, but also it went on during a federal moratorium on gain-of-function research. The problem wasn't simply location. Several projects conducted through nonprofit intermediaries outsourced parts of research to foreign labs, notably Wuhan Institute of Virology under the EcoHealth Alliance, underlining both globalization of biotech and weak oversight that could have been a national security risk. The other labs involved in the creation of the COVID-19 virus include University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, Dr. Ralph Barrick, and the Rocky Mountain NIH Research Laboratory in Hamilton, Montana, under the direction of Anthony Fauci and his division. Another major example is Boston University's hybrid SARS-CoV-2 experiment in 2022. Researchers combined ancestral Omicron strains to create a chimeric virus, resulting in 80% lethality in infected rodents. NIH later stated it hadn't authorized such work. The university insisted it was routine, illustrating ongoing lack of clarity between definitions of gain of function and then P3CO, which is potential pandemic pathogen care and oversight, and other bureaucratic categories. And lastly, there's unreported BSL 3 and 4 lab incidents. A Freedom of Information Act request revealed over 200 documented lab accidents involving infectious materials across federally funded institutions 2004 to 2019, vast majority underreported or sanitized in official summaries, reflecting the chronic transparency deficit in biosecurity research. And just to give you an idea, the Pandora report, which came out recently on December 15th, 2025, by Kellogg and colleagues, highlighted basically a biosecurity breach at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. And this was really a complete disaster. And so this happened through 2024, reported in 2025. Now, there are economic institutional motives. The structure of dual-use research incentives is problematic. The funding dependency, the labs compete for NIH and DOD grants. The pandemic potential becomes an attractive pitch. Big pharma partnerships, companies gain early access to experimental strains that later justify vaccine development contracts. Regulatory capture, the committees overseeing biosafety are often staffed by representatives of the very institutions that regulate, a revolving door that mirrors the pharmaceutical and defense industries. Patent economics, engineering new strains creates new intellectual property for vaccine platforms, incentivizing a cycle of problem creation, solution, sale. By their nature, these dynamics mean that dual-use research cannot be properly disentangled from profit interests. The public faces the risk. Private actors secure the patents and payouts. Now, what are the oversights and mechanisms here and their weaknesses? This P3CO framework, established in 2017 to regulate enhanced potential pandemic pathogens, EPPP, however, the implementation remains murky. There's no public database of approved proposals. Decisions are made behind closed doors. Exemptions easily granted under biodefense or vaccine testing justifications. There's a select agent program. This program nominally monitors possession of regulatory pathogens like anthrax or Ebola. However, enforcement relies on self-reporting and rarely imposes penalty for lab breaches. And number three, Freedom of Information Act evasion. Many projects are classified under national security exemptions, even when conducted by universities. This shields funding sources, biosafety incident reports, and publication data. So the global ramifications are that dual-use pathogen research isn't just a U.S. issue, but because of U.S. dominance in biotech funding and globalization of research partners, U.S. oversight or lack thereof directly shapes the world's biosafety environment. Outsourcing to partner nations amplifies risks through jurisdictional escape. Research that would be illegal in the United States is quietly executed abroad, like in China with creation of SARS-CoV-2. The cycle of create, contain, cure entrenches a dependency on central vaccine production and surveillance systems, further consolidating institutional power over global health. Let me tell you, the next vaccine will probably be a government-issued vaccine with rich profits to the manufacturer. This model effectively transforms pandemics into a recurrent business opportunities with vaccines and diagnostics as profitable endpoints, not as preventive measures. There are ethical and strategic implications. The moral dilemma emerges here. How do we justify research that could save lives if its mere existence could end billions? The argument for preemptive study relies on a utilitarian logic that collapses under real-world incentive structures. No laboratory is 100% secure. Even the BSL-4 facilities experienced leaks, smallpox escape in the UK 1978, or anthrax mishandling at the CDC Center in 2014. Those are just examples. The University of Texas Medical Branch lab leak recently. The energy devoted to hypothetical vaccine prototypes diverts funding from low-risk, high-yield measures like sanitation, air quality improvement, nutritional interventions, and early treatment protocols. Centralizing pandemic science under secrecy perpetuates an arms race of viral enhancement, reminiscent of nuclear proliferation cloaked as biodefense. So in conclusion, rethinking this pandemic preparedness, the U.S. approach to dual pandemic potential pathogens is a paradox wrapped in bureaucracy. On paper, it serves health security. In reality, it creates an ongoing feedback loop. To number one, engineer dangerous pathogens. Number two, model crisis and procure funding. Number three, develop vaccine or for the pathogen that's created. Number four, repeat increasingly under secrecy. This perpetual self-licking ice cream cone of biosurveillance and vaccine development endangers the public under the guise of protecting it. It amplifies why transparency, not secrecy, is a first principle of biosecurity. Until an independent oversight system is in place, this is really beyond self-policing federal committees. The U.S. biosafety landscape will continue to operate as a gray zone of moral hazard, blending scientific ambition, economic incentive, and military influence into one volatile mixture. So in summary, U.S. biolabs working on pathogens of dual pandemic potential embody a dangerously blurred line between health defense and biohazardous offense. While their stated mission is to prevent the next global outbreak, the secrecy, funding incentives, and deficiencies in oversight mean that much more of the research itself may constitute the next outbreak's root cause. The convergence of biotechnology, military defense interests, and pharmaceutical profits have produced an ecosystem where pandemic prevention laboratories, ironically, represent humanity's most consistent pandemic risk, meaning the next pandemic almost certainly is going to come out of a biosecurity lab and not come out of nature.
That was Dr. Peter McCullough reporting on alarming and opaque aspects of biowarfare research of the U.S. Biodefense Network, which spans dozens of federal agencies and hundreds of private and university biolabs. His report can be found at the McCullough Report on America Out Loud Network, dated 29 December 2025. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.